Prepare to experience the strongest radio allowable by law. Secrets will be revealed. Myths dispelled. From the studio gym where excuses never apply, it's Superhuman Radio with your host, Carl Lenore.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of Superhuman Radio. I've been gone a while, and I'm tan. As you know, last week I was in Mexico with the lovely and talented Elisa Profumo, and not only did I work on my tan, as you can see, but I worked on sampling various tequilas. And all I'll say is, when we said we were going to go to Mexico, we said we're going to train every morning, which I did, walk on the beach every morning, which we did. And then turn this into a healthy vacation, which I did not. I started drinking tequila the first night they were there. We were there, and that pretty much solidified the rest of the vacation. So now I'm detoxing. I feel better. I do. I've had enough time to rest. Back in the gym doing my thing, so I feel good. And we're launching. We have a great lineup of shows this week. It's unbelievable. One, on Wednesday, talks about the sun. I'm going to summarize. The sun is the best senolytic you can find, better than rapamycin, better than all of the intermittent fasting. And it doesn't shock me. And I love the sun, as you know. I love to lay in the sun. I do it at every chance I can. And today we're going to talk about sodium and heart failure, which, in my opinion, is a really interesting topic because there's It's still formulating. We're still understanding the role of sodium, the evil role of sodium, one of the most important electrolytes in our body, and how it affects those who are suffering from heart failure. And so we're going to get to that in a little bit. Just let me do something real quick. Here we go. Of course, I have to thank our title sponsor, and that is Legendary Foods, makers of the Tasty Pastry. If you've never tried it, you truly are missing out. The Tasty Pastry started out to be a solution to the Pop-Tart, because Pop-Tarts are no good. They're full of sugar, full of carbs, just not a, and plus crappy product. The genius behind Quest Nutrition, Ron Penna, decided to take on the Pop-Tart at Legendary Foods. And what they came up with is the Tasty Pastry, which is less than 1 gram of sugar, 20 grams of high quality protein. It's really so much better than a Pop-Tart because it actually tastes like you're eating cake. You will swear you, and I say this all the time. You won't be able to get your kids to eat a healthy protein bar, but you will have to wrestle the Tasty Pastries out of their hands regularly, because they taste that good. If you go to shrnetwork.biz/legendary, use the code SHR10, you can save 10% off your order of Tasty Pastries today. Check them out. Let them know that Carl sent you. And now, without further delay, bring my guest on, Dr. Justin Ezekowitz. Welcome to the show. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine, and thanks for having me on, Carl. Yeah. I'd like to hear more about your vacation, as you do look well.
Yeah, look, I mean, everybody was talking Spanish to me. They all thought I was Mexican. They walked up to me and just started talking Spanish, and I'm going, English? English? Yeah. Yeah, I have. I'm Southern Italian, and I did my genetics a few years ago, and I found out that I have 14% Northern African DNA, and so I thrive under the sun. I love it. So this is an important topic. There's a lot of discussion about the role of sodium in the various etiologies of various diseases. And we know sodium is important because you need it in order to function. It's an electrolyte, right? I mean, it's a very important electrolyte, right?
That's correct. And it's one of the things that meant that we were able to get out of the sea and onto the land, and how we maintain that sodium, what we call sodium homeostasis, is really critical. So we were, we had to come onto land at some point, and we did because of a lot of things because of sodium and how it works.
Interesting. Interesting. So, why this study? Don't we already know the role of sodium in the function of heart failure and or even hypertension for that matter?
Yeah, we know a ton about salt, and this is one of the best researched electrolytes that people have done work on is in fact sodium or salt. And the cultural implications of sodium or salt are quite long. It's been traded as an element or as a commodity for a long time. But in the 1800s, this was kind of may predate my existence. I'm not that old, but in the 1800s, people started to do work and say, well, medically, if we have somebody with a lot of excess volume from, say, kidney failure, what they thought was dropsy or heart failure, they said we recommend these different bath salts and different things, and you name it. But one of them was to reduce dietary intake of sodium in a variety of different ways. So published medical literature in the late 1800s, early 1900s, started to look at this as a question. And then from fast forward to there, in the big hypertension studies in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, really focused in on reducing sodium and recognized that role it played in why people have high blood pressure and how simple, you know, dietary interventions could really change the outcome of those individuals. So it's a long study, electrolyte, if you will, and probably the best studied out of all the things we have in our electrolyte panels.
So since you talked about kidneys for a second, because kidneys help regulate all the electrolytes in our body, I had a physician on the show, I guess it's a renal physician, I think he was called, or years ago. This is probably about 5, 6, 7 years ago. And we were talking about other things that had to do with kidneys. And so then I delved into this discussion. I said, let me ask you a question. I said, when are the kidneys working the hardest? And to summarize discussion, when they are attempting to embargo things and keep them in the bloodstream from flowing out. And I said, so theoretically, if you cut your electrolytes, your kidneys work harder. He said, oh, absolutely. I said, then why do they tell people to cut their sodium when they start, and magnesium when they start to display kidney problems? He goes, well, in fact, it's funny you ask that. He says, because one of the things that can stay, well, there's two things that can stave off chronic kidney disease's progression, sodium bicarbonate and sodium chloride, which is table salt. He says, we give people 600 milligrams of those 2 or 3 times a day and their kidney failure doesn't progress. So, you know, they thought they knew about sodium and the kidneys, and all of a sudden it turns out that, wow, this isn't right. Could we be pushing people into kidney problems by restricting their sodium? Has the cardiac community come to any of those realizations? Like, hey, maybe we're making a mistake. We're telling people not to have salt at all.
So it's a great area of cross pollination, which is the kidneys and heart are intimately linked, and we're used to working with our nephrology or kidney doctor colleagues all the time, because in fact they and us always argue as to who knows more about the topic, but they tend to know more about the topic. So we acknowledge that and move on. But one of the things that is the realization is that there's a difference when you're talking about prevention of a disease versus active management of the disease. So preventing people from getting into kidney failure or heart failure versus actively managing when they have developed the disease. And they're very different strategies. And that's one of the reasons why you and I may not take sodium bicarbonate to help manage our electrolytes and our acidity, our acid-base balance in the blood. But somebody with end-stage kidney disease will need to do that because they can't manage it in other ways. And so there is a recognition that those two strategies, they differ when we're trying to talk about prevention. So otherwise healthy people with maybe high blood pressure versus those with end-stage kidney disease or end-stage heart disease. And that's where often the debate is we try to apply one to the other, and they don't always work as anticipated. And that's actually not unusual in medical science, that you can't apply one rule to all stages of a disease or a prevention versus treatment strategy.
Well, and you and I talked about this off the air, and we're going to get into this because we're going to talk about blood viscosity in a moment. But, you know, the human body is so complex that really the one rule applies method should be thrown out immediately, because it's like everything is situational. You know, it just depends, you know, what else is going on there. So let's talk about your research. Describe the design of your study.
Right. So we designed a large clinical trial, and one of the larger clinical trials of its type done in heart disease, which included recruiting people with heart failure. So they had established heart failure from heart failure clinics and clinics very similar to heart failure clinics. We had over 800 people participate in the trial. And what we kind of designed the trial around was it's a randomized trial. So people were randomized or allocated to either being the usual care, which is any recommendations that a physician or a clinician would have given them in their usual clinic visits, such as, you know, you should reduce your salt in your diet. That's a typical thing people say. And then kind of we all move on. Now, versus what we targeted was less than 1500 milligrams of sodium per day. And the goal there was to target a lower sodium overall and see if we could get people's, number one, get people's sodium to be less than 1500 milligrams a day. And secondly, see if that changed the rate of the clinical events. So we think about clinical events, that's things like hospitalization, ER visits, or dying, and also measure their quality of life and functionality. And so large clinical trial, intervention over about a year, and we follow forward people for longer than that, of course. But the main focus was that first year of the intervention.
I had to kill my microphone because I was clearing my throat. Okay, so were these people required to keep diaries, or were they in a metabolic lab?
Yeah, so it's a really important decision we made up front in the trial. Was metabolic kitchens and metabolic labs are wonderful for small short term trials, but terrible for us free living humans because we eat in our communities and our houses, and so we actually designed it to be much more pragmatic. Was we created a menu based system. So our dietitians we have these terrific dietitians from six countries, 20 plus sites, where they created menus. And the menus are actually, that may sound pretty rigid, but they're actually pretty broad, saying, if you're thinking about this, replace it with this, because that changes the sodium content only, not the calories, not the potassium, nothing else, just the sodium. And so we created this menu-based system and then translated them into Spanish as well, because we had lots of sites in Mexico, Colombia, and Chile. And then localize them to the culture because, we don't have a terrific Colombian food in Canada, and likewise, they don't have the same food we eat in Colombia, right? So, the bet we had to really localize it. And so we gave people the intervention, which is the menus. And then what we did, we were to capture what we're eating, and I'm not sure if you've ever done this, but to try to recall what you ate in the last 24 hours, called a 24-hour recall. We're actually terrible as humans at remembering that. And in fact, it's poorly reported, not a terrific way to do things. I have tried to, and I'm terrible at it. So we decided to do something prospective, which is a 3-day food record. So people, as they eat for those 3 days, two regular days and a weekend day, they write down everything they eat going forward throughout those 3 days. And that's actually one of the widely accepted dietary methods to assess what people are eating. Mm-hmm. It turns out you don't get much more after doing 5 days, 7 days, 10 days, right, the longer you go.
Yeah, people eat the same 9 things week in and week out. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's what we realized. So we follow those forward every 3 months for every patient. So we have a really, patient is their own control approach. And people are terrific at recording it. We asked a lot of our participants, and they really stepped up, and they made the changes we could actually also capture in these record recordings.
Okay. My only reason for asking that is because in my experience, people underreport what they perceive as bad behavior and overreport what they perceive as good behavior, and that could skew. But if you gave them items to select, they just have to check, oh, I ate this, this, and that. That simplifies it to where they probably wouldn't go too far off the ranch, so to speak, and stick to the deal. So that's good. You were going to say something?
Yeah, we expect an under and over reporting of about 20%. Oh, and that's actually the standard.
You adjust for that. Yeah, good.
Yeah, and so one of the nice parts is because we have the under and over reporting expected, we expect that every patient, because we have every in sequence, like we have all theirs over a year, that we can actually detect the under and over reporting a little bit better because they're each their own control, plus because all we're trying to pick up is the amount of sodium difference, but we are capturing everything else. We can kind of see if they're under or over reporting in just one element versus another. They're like bad behavior, good behavior. So we actually have a little bit of a micro experiment in there to just look at that same question that you're asking about.
Right. Interesting. So when you selected these people, had they all had cardiac events in the past?
Yeah. All of these people had established heart failure. So they'd all been, in fact, 2/3 of them have had heart failure for over a year. And so it wasn't like a new heart attack and then developing, as most people had had it for over a year, and most people actually quite substantially longer than that.
And, you know, I've read a lot about heart failure, but I've never asked this question, which probably is the first question I should have ever asked when I started to research heart failure. When we say heart failure, we're talking about a heart whose ejection fraction is now showing that the heart can't really do a good job pumping. It's not just stop. It just didn't stop, but it's going to stop eventually, theoretically, right?
Yeah, all hearts stop eventually. So unfortunately, we can't live forever. I know you're trying to make sure that we can live longer, but we can't live forever, unfortunately. But that's a very nice way of describing heart failure. Is the heart as a pump does, you know, really two things. It squishes blood out to the rest of our body, to brain, kidneys, the rest of our muscles. And when it's the heart muscles weakened overall, the ejection fraction, what you're referring to, is lower. And the other way that it's damaged is when it can squish well, but it can't relax well. Actually, mm-hmm. So when people have high blood pressure, the heart muscle gets too thick. And that's not a good type of muscle lifting, muscle thickness. It's not good. And it can't relax well, so it can't actually function well. And it produces a different type of heart failure that is very common in people who have high, for example, high blood pressure, older, and have other diseases as well.
Interesting. Okay, so how much sodium did they actually consume? And we're looking at sodium exclusively, right? I'm not saying salt, but the sodium portion of the salted foods that they're eating, right?
Correct. Yeah, we're just talking about sodium, and we focused in on sodium as the kind of focus. In fact, we called the trial the sodium HF trial because we're very focused in on that. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we first did was our expectations was we wanted to get about a 500 milligrams of sodium per day reduction. That was our goal. We wanted to get people below 1,500 as the actual target, but we estimated it was about a 500 milligram difference. Coming into the trial, patients at baseline had about 2,200 milligrams of sodium per day. So remember, this is when we've done large surveys of just regular free-living people without heart disease, it's maybe higher than that. Different parts of the country, higher than that. But as people develop heart disease and they get some counseling, they do make some changes. So these people are eating kind of on average about 2,200 milligrams per day of sodium when they started the trial. And the patients in the kind of usual care arm with no change, they kind of continued doing that, with about a 3% drop or so overall over 12 months. And the patients who are in the intervention arm, they dropped by about 28%, by about 415 or so milligrams per day of sodium. So they dropped about 415 milligrams per day, which is a sizable amount. Like a quarter of their sodium has gone out of their diet.
Let's also put this into everyday terms for a second. So sodium chloride is 50-50, right? It's half chloride and half sodium. So if you're consuming 2,200 milligrams of sodium chloride a day, that's about 1,100 milligrams of sodium, right?
So it's a little bit more nebulous. This is a sodium component only. So it's a little, we say it's just the sodium component because there's potassium salts and there's other ways that chloride comes into the play a role.
Right.
So we just talk. We think we call it 2,200 milligrams of sodium rather than 2,200 milligrams of salt. So we actually avoid that extra amount that would be on top of that.
The reason I'm delineating that is because, so theoretically, if you tell somebody you want them on 1,800 milligrams of sodium a day, that could be almost 4,000 milligrams of salt, salt. I mean, so they're not starving for sodium. They're not starving for salt, I should say. They're still getting plenty of salt, but you're just reducing the amount of the sodium component. I get it. That's brilliant. It's brilliant. So what did you find out?
Well, first of all, a couple of key findings. The overall primary outcome or the main outcome of the trial was to reduce the risk of all-cause death, heart failure, cardiovascular hospitalizations and cardiovascular ER visits. And statistically, it did not reduce those the way we formally tested and make sure that it's well understood. Numerically, though, there are fewer events in the people who are in the lower sodium arm of the trial. So people did have fewer events, but not statistically so. And that could be for many reasons. But one of the keys is we're pretty conservative in our interpretation of that as we designed the trial to test the one hypothesis. It did not change the clinical outcomes overall. That's the conservative opinion, but there were numerically fewer events in the lower sodium arm than the usual care arm. So we have to be very careful that I don't misconstrue that. Right. But it does indicate that there's some effect, just not the effect that we had anticipated we would hopefully see.
Okay, so if I remember looking at the study, there were two levels of sodium intake, right? In the low sodium diet, correct?
Correct.
Did the people how did they compare those two groups in their outcomes?
Well, yeah. So, number one, because it's a randomized trial, so at baseline they're very similar. They look the same. Well, like the groups look the same, but the people in the low sodium arm had about 11% fewer clinical events over the year. But that's not statistically significant based on how we did the trial. We're probably underpowered. That is, if we did a three times the size trial, we might be able to demonstrate a statistical difference in that, but we're too underpowered to demonstrate that. That's okay. We designed it this is the first large trial of its type, so the subsequent trials have to be done to really show that, if there's any difference. We did have some other interesting outcomes, though, which I think you might be really interested, Carl, because they're the ones that people really care about, and that is, you know, function. How am I going to feel in a year? And the backdrop of this is that when we started the trial, the pushback from clinicians and even ethics boards or patients was, you can't keep people on a lower sodium diet because they're going to feel worse. And actually, that's not an unusual statement. That wasn't just not a rare beast. That was a common statement. So we tracked quality of life through some very formal surveys. And in fact, quality of life was better on the lower sodium arm than it was in the usual care by a very meaningful amount. So it's on a special scale called the KCCQ. And it was meaningfully better on the lower sodium arm than in the usual care group. That means the lower sodium arm was kind of overall quality of life was better. And then we paired that with the clinician's assessment of whether or not their clinicians felt they were doing better overall. It's called the New York Heart Association class. And that kind of assesses the clinician's overall gestalt of how this patient's doing. That also improved on the lower sodium arm compared to usual care. So you put those together, and we think that patients were doing better overall on the lower sodium arm from those perspectives. Quality of life was better. And I think that's not to be lost for many of our patients. That's the one thing they really want.
That's so fascinating. I wouldn't think that you would feel low sodium versus high sodium. But I guess so the next question is kind of backing into this discussion. Why just sodium? We know that magnesium has a profound effect on people who are magnesium deficient and suffering from heart failure. I want to ask you this question. So it's my understanding that the heart doesn't relax. It's like a bellows, right? If you're pushing down to blow the wind out, but then you're pulling to suck the wind back in again. And you have antagonistic muscle fibers, some that are concentrically driven and some that are eccentrically driven. And heart failure can occur, and again, I'm not a scientist, but heart failure can occur, as you point out, when the heart doesn't want to relax. And relax really is the wrong term. We should say when the heart wants to go in the eccentric direction, because the concentric fibers are still stiff and holding, and so the heart has to struggle to open up and gain volume. And we know that magnesium is the mineral responsible for relaxing calcium channel activity and allowing the heart to expand. Why are we looking at just sodium when magnesium could be the reason some people do well and some people don't? Maybe some people had a higher magnesium status.
It's a great way, and you really explained it really well, Carl. And this is actually, you're reflecting like the 2022 knowledge of the active, what we call metabolic. It takes energy. It's all those things. It's not like a passive process.
Right.
I'll come to magnesium in a moment. But one of the things that we realized in that process is that it is very much driven by the fuel people are eating and the different switches we have inside the heart muscle cells and the mitochondria and outside the mitochondria inside the cell. So it is driven by a lot of different processes. Many of the things. Magnesium would be one, vitamins another. There's many of these little, what we call micronutrients, which may or may not play a role. But it isn't, it's likely no one element. And this is why I think people are a little reluctant to say it's just magnesium or it's just, you know, calcium or it's just, you name the electrolyte. And we're very careful about that because every time we've kind of looked at this, we think about, you know, blasting the body with things like magnesium, for example, taking magnesium supplements, versus, is that magnesium being used locally where it needs to be working, so in the heart muscle cells itself. So I think we think that that's the case, but actually that's not always the case. And the largest trials of using magnesium supplementation, IV magnesium during heart attacks, really haven't shown a difference. So if ever there was going to be a scenario where it could work best, it would be in kind of these acute situations.
Okay, so here's the next question, the follow-up question. Insulin affects all of these electrolytes and how they make it into the cell, make it out of the cell. Insulin can cause imbalances in calcium versus another mineral in a cell. These all affect contractile force of a muscle. And we're talking about a muscle when we talk about the heart. Could the reason that some people respond better than others, could it be their level of insulin resistance? Since that plays a role in all of these minerals doing their job.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a super important one, is the insulin resistance and the kind of what we, you know, the metabolic perturbations that happen around people as they age. They may have things that are concurrently happening, diabetes, obesity. Generally, there's a lot of factors that can play there. But there's a couple of really good researchers who've looked into what these metabolic switches from free fatty acids to glycogen or glucose and
ketones and ketones now too, because endogenous ketones and ketones are a big discussion now as well, and the heart likes ketones.
Yeah. So this is the other part is the heart failure. When you think about the fuels that it likes and the ones it doesn't like, ketone esters and ketone products are the things it likes a lot. And that's very similar to these elite athletes who are drinking ketone drinks. You know, the question is whether or not you can recreate that environment that the heart will like better using ketones. And these are open questions of active investigation. Some of it's still in animal models because that's we really have to understand it. And some of them are actually progressing into human studies. And I think that's a really exciting area. It's all intimately linked to insulin and ketones and free fatty acids and how they play off in a normal heart muscle cell versus a diseased heart muscle cell.
I want to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, I want you to kind of give me a brief summary of what conclusions should be taken, because then I want to walk into a different realm. I want to start to talk about athletic type people, because all of this research we do today is on average people. And in 2004, I was supposed to have a pacemaker put in. I don't have a pacemaker today. And I chose to try to handle it myself. And I became a more athletic person and my heart changed. So we know there's pathological and physiological changes to the heart that look the same to a clinician, but aren't really the same. So let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, tell us what clinicians should take away from your research, and then let's have some fun and go in a different direction. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more Superhuman Radio. Here we go.
If you'd like a shortcut to better sleep, more energy, and calmer, more stable moods, then you should make sure you're supplementing with magnesium daily. Let me tell you why. About 75% of people are magnesium deficient. This deficiency can lead to higher levels of anxiety, irritability, trouble sleeping, and low energy. It can even contribute to foot and leg cramps while you sleep. Magnesium Breakthrough by Bioptimizers is the single best magnesium supplement in the world. Simply take two capsules before you go to bed, and you'll be amazed by the improvements in your mood and energy levels and how much more rested you feel when you wake up. I take Magnesium Breakthrough Breakthrough every night, and I sleep better because I use it. Go to magbreakthrough.com/SHR and use the code SHR10 during checkout to save 10% off and get free shipping. Check it out. C60, also known as Buckminster Fullerene, is the most powerful, most versatile antioxidant in the world. It's been shown in studies to double the lifespan of rodents. We all know the importance of taking antioxidants to slow aging, reduce inflammation, and improve mitochondrial function and energy production. But there are literally hundreds of antioxidants that would cost you thousands of dollars to take every day. I take one. I take C60 from C360 Health. Revive and Rejuvenate are two blends that harness the power of C60. Don't waste another minute. Go to shrnetwork.biz/revive and use the code SHR for 15% off and free shipping inside the United States today. If you've listened to this show for any length of time, you know that I have struggled to give up coffee for years. Coffee has destroyed my gut and it's impaired my health. Well, I haven't had coffee in months thanks to a product called Magic Mind. Magic Mind is the first nootropic blend I actually feel working. One shot and I'm good all day long. My memory is crystal clear and I'm able to function and have great focus without coffee or caffeine for that matter. If you want to try a product that really works, if you're like me and you want to give up coffee forever, or you just need something occasionally that will help you lift the brain fog, Magic Mind is your product. I promise you that this product you will feel when you use it. Go to shrnetwork.biz/magicmind, all one word, and use the code SHR for a whopping 20% off your first order. Remember those rectangular toaster pastries you used to love when you were a kid? Well, Legendary Foods has just made them better. The new cake-style tasty pastry is like nothing you've ever had before. With 20 grams of high-quality protein and less than 1 gram of sugar, you'll feel like you're cheating, but you're not. Go to shrnetwork.biz/legendary and use the code SHR10 to save 10% off your purchase of tasty pastries. Now available in cookies and cream, red velvet cake, birthday cake, blueberry, strawberry, brown sugar cinnamon, and hot fudge sundae. Go to shrnetwork.biz/legendary and use code SHR10 today. Most people have heard of phytoestrogens, but did you know there are beneficial phytoandrogens? The top source of these is pine pollen. It even contains trace amounts of testosterone and DHEA. If you're looking for a 100% natural testosterone booster, this is worth trying. Lots of men love it, and it even works for women. Lost Empire Herbs offers the highest quality wild harvested non-irradiated pine pollen backed by a 365-day money-back guarantee. It works for you or you don't have to pay for it with nothing to send back. Go to shrnetwork.biz/lostempire. Use code SHR. Get 15% off your order today.
Dogs should be powered by fat and protein, not carbs. That's why Visionary Pet makes low-carb, ketogenic dog food for dogs of all breeds and life stages. From kibble to freeze-dried and even low-carb treats, all Visionary Pet recipes are very low-carb, ketogenic, and made with 100% real meat protein. Shop now and use code SHR for 20% off your first order today. Your dog deserves the lifelong benefits of optimal nutrition. Make the switch to Visionary and see why smart dogs eat low-carb.
This is the Superhuman Channel, doing reps with the weight of the world.
Welcome back. We're talking to Dr. Justin Ezekowitz, and we're talking about sodium and heart failure. So what is the takeaway from your research? What should clinicians pay attention to?
Sure. So there's kind of three kind of crystal clear messages from our trial, other than we've got to do more trials like this.
Yes.
Number one is, you know, clinicians need to consider salt or sodium reduction for patients with heart failure to improve quality of life. So rethink the goals of why we're doing this and why we're suggesting it. Less finger wagging, less shame and blame. But it is as part of a therapy to improve dietary health. Sodium can be there to improve quality of life. And for patients, I think this should be part of their overall health strategy to consider a healthier diet overall. And for guidelines and those who make policies, really this is the best evidence we have, and we need to continue to improve that.
Okay. Now let's talk about athletes for a second, or athletic types, okay? I often wish that science would start saying, you know, I remember doing a show years ago that a lot of trials only used male rodents because of pesky estrogen hormones and the unlikely outcomes of knowing what would happen. And now science is paying attention to female as well as males when they do pharmaceutical drug tests and so on and so forth. I hope that science catches on to looking at outcomes in athletic type people, people like me who train 5, 6, 7 days a week, who manage our sleep and make sure that we're getting quality sleep and choose foods that really are good for us and not just because the label says it's good for us. In fact, if it has a label, you probably should avoid it. But with that being said, you know, there are physiological changes to the heart and there are pathological changes to the heart. They can look very similar to the clinician, right? An enlarged heart where the sinuses are bigger and the wall is still nice and thin is very, very different than an enlarged heart where the sinuses are small and the walls are thick, right?
Yeah, no, this is one of the fundamental key learning from actually some of the best studies are with Tour de France riders, cyclists, was really understanding that from, you know, soccer players, Norwegian skiers, is that they get a very much different type of thickening of the heart muscle, even though if you did an ultrasound, they may look very similar initially. When you start to look closer and delve a bit deeper, they're not the same. And so, you know, Tour de France athletes have been really well studied by their the thickening of the heart muscle. It's not pathologic. It's actually more to be physiologic. The balance there is you put it, they're in a different category to begin with. And so we're always trying to understand, is that just they were got into the becoming athletes because of who they were and how they did things, and so they were predestined to be healthier, or is that just we were lucky in that the thickening is very different? So I think you're right, Carl, that they're not the same.
And with that being said, I use ketone salts as a pre-workout. I have a great product that I like made by a company called Audacious Nutrition. And so I'll go ahead and plug them now. But I take those before I work out because I like to train fasted. I don't want food in my stomach that is requiring the blood to go to my stomach and do work. But I want that energy. I want that energetic feeling. I want that alternate hybrid fuel available for my heart and for my brain and other tissue as well. And so athletes use ketones. A lot of people in my audience probably use ketones because we are more athletic types. With that being said, I have an N equals one story to tell you, and then I'd like you to opine. I have a friend that we used to go to the same gym together for about 10 years. His name is Bill, and he trains very hard. And like me, we're big fans of sauna. Now, I consume a lot of sodium in the day. Salt. You know, I consume it a variety of different ways, whether it's present in the food I'm eating or whether I'm salting my food. And I do that purposefully because I sweat a lot all day long. The average person doesn't sweat. With that being said, Bill confided in me, this is about 5 years ago, he said, you know, every time he goes to the doctor, he puts him on higher doses of blood pressure medicine because his blood pressure is going up. He doesn't understand it. And I just, in passing, said, do you avoid salt? And he said, yeah, I do. And I said, Bill, you're in here training an hour and a half a day, sitting in the sauna for 45 minutes a day, and then you're starving yourself of salt. I said, why don't you try start salting your food? Long story short, 8 months later, he's not on any blood pressure meds, but he salts his food now. So, you know, this is a very complex discussion to have because we have different people in the population whose bodies function completely different because of their lifestyles. So should everybody be on a low sodium diet in your opinion?
So my blanket answer to that is going to be yes, but, and the reason we probably need more people on a lower sodium diet than not, from a population health perspective, you know, it's 3 to 350 million people in the US, for example, and globally 8 billion people, in general, the majority of those people should be on a lower sodium diet. And I think that's partially because for most people that leads to the beneficial effects. Now, the reason why there's a but in there is that we have to also think about there are going to be naturally people who are going to be more sensitive, more salt sensitive hypertension, and those who are not. And there's going to be differences in the way we regulate our sodium, our renal function, you name it. And so the key there is in general for helping, you know, human health, it's better to be on a lower sodium diet. That's in general. And then there's going to be the outliers, and that's okay. And we have to just recognize those better. And for an individual, that's quite important. So we don't always have all the answers, but we can say what is generally the right strategy for a population. And then sometimes for individuals, we have to really hone down there and understand them better.
It's really easy to cut your sodium intake if you stop buying things in boxes with labels.
Yeah.
Like if you eat a more Mediterranean diet where you eat fish and pork chops or and vegetables, and your sodium disappears in your diet, technically. I mean, unless you eat a lot of tomato sauce, you know, drinking a lot of tomato juice, then. But really, right? Isn't this a problem of modernity and modern food production?
Yeah, so this is, you know, the general advice when I'm seeing my patients, and as a reminder, I'm not a dietitian, and if anybody ever watches me eat, they know I'm not a dietitian. I like to eat good food, but I do my best. But I was taught by a very smart dietitian a long time ago, the best advice you can give to a patient is to avoid things in a box, a bag, or a can. And if you think about it, those are the things that have higher sodium in them. They're generally also not healthier, generally speaking. That doesn't mean they're not all healthy, but it's kind of stuck with me. But with modernity, as you mentioned, we are looking for faster meals, more refined products. Fewer of the kind of raw products kind of get to our plate. So the raw vegetable, the raw piece of meat, if that's what you like, or the raw chickpeas, they're all processed in a way that has been gone through the mill in a different way. I think we need to think about that carefully and also make healthier choices overall. Reading labels is actually a skill and an art. I challenge people to really get down and understand them. It's actually not easy. And as a patient, our patients struggle with that.
I find that once you cut out packaged foods, because they put sodium in packaged foods for a variety of reasons, shelf life, flavor, it just goes on and on. And you know who's the worst at this? The American government. I was involved in a project with Quest Nutrition about 8 years ago. We were actually looking at making a bar, a ketone bar for the military. And so we received data, all the information about what they feed these men and women in the military. And it's majority of it's salt and sugar. I mean, literally, it's like the first two ingredients are sugar and salt, and then beef and gravy. And, it's like, why do they do this to these people that are supposed to be athletes? And they have to perform in war, mortal combat. It baffles me. The government is the worst at this. So let's talk about what we talked about earlier off the air. There's a group of people out there who say blood viscosity is more important than blood volume. And in fact, we now have blood viscosity tests at LabCorp and other places. The idea is that consuming more salt or sodium is good because it brings fluid, water, into the blood and makes it less viscous. And more viscous blood is thick, and it's like trying to pump mud instead of liquid. But you said that this is there's a lot of flaws in this idea, huh?
Yeah, and there's a lot more unknown about that issue. So the blood viscosity has been studied for a long time. It's been well studied. And there's older tests, like the ESR is a classic old test of blood viscosity, and then there's newer tests, and there's not just one new test, there's 5 or 10 new tests of how to do it. They don't always agree with each other, and part of that is it's a tricky area to study. But in general, the blood viscosity is tightly regulated, and it's not like we suddenly go from having molasses to having a nice olive oil flowing through our veins. It's actually much more uniform and variations of tiny fractions of a percent. And that's because the blood viscosity is made up of everything from proteins and cells as well as electrolytes, drawing things in, drawing things out. But then each area of the body, it's like your local community. You've got your street you live on, your neighborhood, your city, state, and country, and they're all regulated very tightly as to what they need for their environment. And I recall before we came on the air, I kind of used the analogy, in the lung arteries, they're tiny capillaries. They have one red cell going through at a time, and they're doing gas exchange. So their viscosity is very different than, say, in our muscles, which is also muscle capillaries, which are one cell at a time. But they're doing a very different energy and ion exchange. So they're going to be naturally very different. So blood viscosity out of our antecubital vein, where they draw blood, isn't necessarily reflective of what our blood viscosity is in another part of the body, or what it even could or should be at that very moment in time.
We have some comments from some of the people in the audience. Let's just get these up here. A couple of them are pretty interesting. So Craig Hollander says that he responds extremely well to high-quality salt added to each meal and coconut water, orange juice mixture. The added salt decreases and almost eliminates years of intense nocturnal muscle cramping. Now, what is extremely well? I would say, what are you using to gauge? Are you a lot of us take salt before we train. I find that when I consume my ketone salts, which has a robust amount of sodium in it, that I can train better. I get a better muscle pump. I feel better. So I would say to Craig, what is your gauge for feeling better? But I understand the nocturnal muscle cramps. All the tequila I drank in Mexico, I got Charlie horses in my left calf like almost every night. And that's because alcohol is a diuretic, right? I mean, it really does act as a strong diuretic. Diego Paparella has a comment here that makes a good question. As you increase sodium, blood pressure goes up only temporarily. As aldosterone decreases, then it will stabilize. The medical community only sees the small amount of increase for a short period of time. Is that an accurate statement?
It's getting it the right direction. Is that aldosterone and renin is another hormone that's directly involved in this process. Is they do change in response to intravenous sodium, like giving sodium chloride at like 0.9% so or higher. But over time is a normalization of that. And in fact, those hormones are also tightly coupled and in fact are responsible in some cases for high blood pressure over time, but they do come down, but not back to their base level. And in fact, once people, this is back to that issue about prevention versus people with disease, people with heart disease or kidney disease or high blood pressure, they actually have very different responses to those, to any like food or intravenous sodium. So it's not, they're not the same as, say, an 18-year-old healthy individual. Sometimes we have to decouple those as part of their response to the aldosterone response or the renin response.
So the renin response plays a big role in this discussion about blood pressure anyway, right? I mean, that's part of the role of the kidneys to keep stable blood pressure in every angle and position you go into, right?
Yeah, I mean, I spend all day long helping manage patients with their renin, angiotensin, aldosterone blockers. And it seems like a mouthful, but that's because renin is a critical thing in terms of high blood pressure. And in fact, direct renin inhibitors were developed as a blood pressure medication because if you control the renin levels, you can control blood pressure better and maybe protect the kidneys more. It hasn't panned out in the same way that they anticipated because it's a pretty complex system, and you tilt one, you might not get the effects on the other, and for some people it might be the angiotensin system that needs more blockade, and some need the renin. So it is a pretty tightly coupled system, and this is where we have to be a little bit smarter, but that individual's he's on the right track. It's important, but I'd say it's important what he's saying.
Okay. We're going to take our last commercial break. We'll wrap up the interview. Stay with us. We'll be right back with more of Dr. Justin Ezekowitz and Superhuman Radio. Being superhuman means being conscientious about the choices we make. White Oak Pastures is superhuman when it comes to raising livestock. They're committed to animal welfare, land regeneration, and rural revival. They responsibly manage the entire process from the pasture to your doorstep. High-quality, pasture-raised, great-tasting meat from a farm you can trust. Full nose-to-tail selections. They even have options for your pet. Go to shrnetwork.biz/whiteoak and use the code SUPERHUMAN to save 10% off your entire first order.
More than 240 million Americans take supplements daily in pill form, but poor nutrient absorption means the promised results are rarely achieved. Healthy Cell uses a clinically proven patent-pending gel delivery system that increases absorption by 165% over pill form. Go to shrnetwork.biz/healthycell, that's HEALTHYCELL today, and use the code SHR to save 20% off your purchase of Healthy Cell supplements. Are you 35 or older? Every year after puberty, your growth hormone decreases sometimes by 50% by the age of 35, and it only keeps going down from there. This affects everything from making it harder to recover from workouts, sleep, and a general loss of a sense of well-being. It also affects your ability to get and stay lean. BioPro Plus is the first of its kind 100% non-synthetic alternative to prescription synthetic growth hormone treatments. All the benefits without any of the needles or side effects, and 100% safe. Previously only available through doctors you can go to shrnetwork.biz/biopro, that's B-I-O-P-R-O, and use code SHR30 for $30 off today. Plant medicine has become all the rage for mental optimization. Now there's an ancient plant medicine rapidly growing in popularity that experts believe might just be the alcohol of the future. It's called True Kava. Kava is a natural food-grade elixir that has been used for over 3,000 years by South Pacific Islanders as safe, non-addictive alternative to drugs and alcohol. By naturally boosting the brain's main feel-good chemicals, dopamine, serotonin, and GABA, Kava provides you with both increased relaxation and mental clarity at the same time. True Kava is a new form of stabilized full-spectrum traditional Kava that is third-party lab-tested for quality and safety. Go to shrnetwork.biz/truekava, and that's T-R-U-K-A-V-A, all one word, and use code SHR for 25% off today. You may be wondering why you're experiencing performance issues in the bedroom, but you're not alone. Over 30 million men experience a form of erectile dysfunction, and to many, it can feel defeating. Maybe you've tried pills, diets, exercise, but finally there's a proven solution. Meet Eddy, a discreet device designed to help men strengthen and maintain their erections. Pills can be costly and result in debilitating side effects, so I checked out Eddy by Giddy at shrnetwork.biz/Eddy and found out that over 95% of men experience positive results wearing Eddy, according to a 2021 clinical trial. This product simply works and is easy to use. Sign up for a subscription at shrnetwork.biz/Eddy and save $20 on your first device with promo code SUPER20. With free device resizes and 60-day guarantee, you'll be glad you tried it. Treat ED with Eddy at shrnetwork.biz/Eddy. That's E-D-D-I-E.
New Mass Pro Synthogen X2 just upped its own legendary game. To distance itself even further from the rest of the pack, Synthogen X2 now has double the key active ingredients. If you've ever wondered what steroid-like recovery feels like, Synthogen X2 delivers. See why others compare it favorably to powerful bodybuilding drugs at Synthogen.com. Mass Pro Synthogen. When you train with it, you'll gain with it.
You're listening to the Superhuman Channel. Don't hate us because we feel good.
There's a discussion going on in the community area about ARBs being the best alternative for hypertension. I think get your hypertension under control naturally, and there are ways to do that. I think that's the best thing because we didn't think there were proton pumps in the brain or the heart, but it turns out there are. And when you take a proton pump inhibitor, it could speed along dementia or cause your heart to malfunction. Let's just shut down angiotensin. Now it's let's block the receptor. These are not, none of these are, look, if you're, you need to be rescued, if you're sick, you're dying, we have to do these things to get you to a position where you can pick up the ball and go yourself. But the best thing is to get your hypertension under control. Look at your sleep. A lot of people have obstructive sleep apnea, don't even know it. Record your sleep one night, you'll be shocked. And then you get your sleep straightened out, watch what happens to your blood pressure. But anyway, did we miss anything, Dr. Ezekowitz?
No, Carl, you really covered it well. I mean, I think just even on the last comment that you just made, talking about blood pressure naturally, I think that's really important that people can do a lot for themselves, self-care, and that's important. So people never like to hear my advice, which is, you know, we actually have to get our sleep patterns better. You have to exercise more. You have to get more stress control, and you have to eat well. They don't like to hear that because those are hard, sometimes really hard for people to do. But if we can't get your blood pressure under control, then the medications matter to prevent stroke, heart disease, and kidney failure. Right. Like, it's really straightforward. And if we just want to do everything we can, the fewest number of medications possible, sometimes we need them, and that's okay. So for my study, I'd say there's nothing else. We covered a ton of material here, Carl, and I really appreciate your listeners actually hearing me out on my science. I'm obviously passionate about the area, and we could talk all day about it.
Thanks for being here, Dr. Ezekowitz.
My pleasure, and thanks for having me on. You look so good. It's my pleasure to be on here.
I'm 63 years old.
I wouldn't believe it.
Yeah. Thank you. Take care.
Take care.
I got a brief little rant I have to go with right now, so stay with me for a second. You know, in 2006 and 2007, I did covered two studies, one from the California VA, where they followed 26,000 men over the course of 10 years, and they established that the men who had the strongest leg strength doing a one rep max leg press and maintained that strength through the study period lived the longest. So that was the first study to establish a link between muscle strength and longevity. About a year or two later, we talked about another study that showed grip strength and longevity. And I've been talking about muscle being metabolic currency since this show started. And the stronger you are, the longer you will live. It's proven in science now. But I was too early to the party. I was talking about this stuff in 2006, 2007, and now everybody's talking about it today like it's this mystery, like, oh, my God, this is amazing. And we actually have people out there that are just doing grip work. They're like, well, I'm going to live forever because I'm going to just make my forearm so damn strong. Look, leg strength is an outgrowth of physical strength. Grip strength is an outgrowth of physical strength. You're not going to beat the odds by just doing grip work and live longer, or doing just leg presses and live longer. You must be a strong human being. The evidence that muscle is an organ of great value that produces all sorts of great hormones, and it even produces leptin. I mean, we thought just fat did that. Oh, no, it doesn't. The more muscle you carry, there was one study we talked about probably about 4 or 5 years ago that showed that men up to the age of 65, women up to the age of 60, the ones who continued to maintain their muscularity lived longer and had better health. We talked about this 2006 and 2007. Peter Attia, great guy. I love him. Dr. Peter Attia. Lane Norton, they're all getting mad publicity right now. They're talking about strength and longevity. I just posted a mem last month that said if your anti-aging guru isn't talking to you about heavy resistance training to increase longevity, fire them because they don't know anything. Rapamycin, yeah, I take it. You know what? It's novel. Intermittent fast, yeah, it's novel. But the greatest value that you can invest in your body that will ensure you to live long and be healthy, health span and lifespan are mutually important, is build muscle and keep building muscle. What did I start saying about 5-6 years ago? Stronger is younger. People say, oh, I wish I could get younger. I wish I could reverse aging. Get stronger. Because if you're stronger today than last week, then you're younger today than last week. I know it sounds like I'm crying in my beer here, like, oh, everybody's getting, but it's the truth. We talked about this stuff in 2006, 2007. This audience knew this stuff all along. Now, all of a sudden, all these people are like, oh, my God, did you know that grip strength, if your grip strength is good, you're going to live longer? No, it's not. You have to be strong. Being strong makes you harder to kill, period. End of story. And that's it for today. We have great shows all week. I hope you can tune in. Don't forget, share this show. You never know whose life you're going to save or even change when you share a show. Share this show. This one is worthy of sharing. We'll see you tomorrow with more Superhuman Radio. Thanks for being here today.